As you've heard on the bulletins this morning, and it's impossible to miss Salman Rushdie, the novelist is on a ventilator and may lose an eye after he was attacked on stage in New York State yesterday. The assault on the Indian-born British author has been described as an assault on freedom of thought and speech. Well, I'm joined now by Martina Devlin, writer and Irish Independent columnist. Martina, you're very welcome. The world has been reacting to this shocking attack. Salman Rushdie is a huge cultural figure.
Yes, I mean, he's got a very important position in what you might call the cultural marketplace. His literary career spans five decades. He's one of the most celebrated and successful British authors, twice named best of all the Booker winners. And this is a very distinctive and weighty presence across various creative platforms that he occupies, not only as a novelist and short story writer, but also as a public intellectual. And he writes about colonialism and its legacy. So that's of particular interest in Ireland. He writes about Eastern and Western culture, and he also notably writes specifically about Islam. The novels are allegorical, surreal. They examine historical and philosophical issues, and they're characterized by quite a brooding, dark humor and a very expansive prose style. And interestingly, he says he learned his craft from his experience as an advertising copywriter. I remember that he wrote some of the most celebrated slogans of the 1980s, and he's spoken about them. They include "naughty but nice" to advertise cream cakes, and that will do nicely for American Express cards. And another one he was very proud of was "irresistible" for Aero. And he said that this work in advertising taught him to write like a job. He said, if you have the client coming in the afternoon for a new ad campaign, you can't not have it. And what's more, it has to be good.
You actually had an opportunity to meet him in person and interview him. That must have been an extraordinary experience.
Yes, it was in London in the early 90s. So he went into hiding, I think, around the heel end of 1989 or so. And I was sent to interview an unidentified figure who was in the news. So I didn't know. My chief news editor just said, you have to jump through these various hoops. We don't know why, but where you have it on good authority, it'll be worth it. Security was very tight. There was no information. And I was with a small group of journalists from various English newspapers. I worked for the Press Association at the time, and we were ushered into a room, and there he was, just sitting. And he must have seen how astonished we were. And he just burst out laughing, and he laughed and laughed. In fact, it was giggles at times. And then everybody said, well, none of us laughed. We were just too amazed, because he was perhaps one of the most famous figures in the world at the time. His life had changed dramatically because of the fatwa against him issued by the Ayatollah Khomeini. And then he, you know, we recovered from our surprise, asked him some questions, and it was a much more serious interview then. It lasted for quite a long time, and he talked at length about what it was like living in fear of his life, about the death threat, about how it wouldn't deter him from writing. But he also said, and this was quite a human element, he hoped he wouldn't always have to spend his life in hiding.
And it is extraordinary.
It's
extraordinary, Martina, when you think of what happened after after the fatwa was issued. The Ayatollah Khomeini passed away after that, but this terror followed him, and it wasn't just to him personally. There were bombings, there were killings all over the world associated with the satanic verses. So the impact lingered. So I suppose there was always maybe a sense of risk surrounding him, even though this happened, 33 years ago now?
Yes. His life changed in a very dramatic way as a result of that fatwa. And although he did come out of hiding after a number of years, there must always have been a sense of looking over his shoulder. I mean, he has written about it. He used the pseudonym Joseph Anton while he was in hiding. In fact, he complained that his security detail always referred to him as Joe. And that was a tribute to Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. And, you know, in his memoir about it, it was very clear the pressure of this furtive, limiting experience. And his family suffered too. I mean, his marriage to an American writer, Marianne Wiggins, broke up. I remember we asked him about his family, and he acknowledged that it was very difficult for people. And he did acknowledge that translators and publishers were under attack and someone had died. I mean, at that time in England, when I was living there, the book was being burned in public in Bradford. W.H. Smith, the book chain, stopped stocking it, and he was very upset about things like this because he saw it as giving into radicalism. Airlines judged him too big a risk to carry, and really, you know, it's amazing it didn't wreck sanity. He subsequently, Bono was one of the people who came out and supported him. He was very upset that some other writers did or didn't support him, but Bono had him to stay sometimes in Killiney in Dublin, and he also had him appear at one of his concerts, and that caused quite a sensation as well in the 90s. You know, he just suddenly appeared on stage, and he did seem to enjoy these opportunities to appear in public, even though there would have been a lot of risk attached.
And he did appear to enjoy Ireland. It wasn't just the association with the U2 frontman Bono. He has also spoken at the Dalkey Book Festival. He travelled here and did speak about his experiences.
Yes, I went to hear him speak at the Dalkey Book Festival, I suppose partly because I remembered meeting him that time in London. You look, it's something you'll never forget. Like, you'll forget the sort of nitty gritty of the detail of what he said, but you'll never forget all the hoopla around it and just meeting this man who you know, could be assassinated at any time and who's very conscious of that threat. And I mean, he was as erudite and articulate as I remembered when he spoke at the Dalkey Book Festival. There was also a sense of humour and a wit, you know, which the audience responded to. And I remember seeing Leo Varadkar in the audience. He was a minister at the time before he was tarnished or a Taoiseach. And I spoke to Leo Varadkar afterwards and I said, I didn't know you were a fan of Salman Rushdie. He said, I'm here for my father. He's from Mumbai as well. And he went and queued up to get his book signed, which was more than I did because I looked at the length of the queue and said no. But he certainly had a presence as this public intellectual who was also quite accessible. One other thing I remember, Derval, is that he had a young son at the time when he was in hiding, and he talked about how he couldn't even do normal things like kick about a football with his son. You know, that the normal, the commonplaces of life, he really appreciated now because they were no longer available to him. And in that memoir that he wrote, he also spoke about how Bono smuggled him into the local pub in Dalkey for about half an hour, got him away from his bodyguards. And he was just giddy with the unprotected freedom of it. And he seems to have had some Guinness as well.
Obviously, we're just keeping an eye on updates here and hoping that from the hospital. I know his agent last night said he was on an event later and unable to speak. Obviously, he's been treated in hospital at present. But the literary world, just finally, Martina, has roundly condemned this attack. But as an author, you must know that this attack puts fear into the hearts of artists and writers everywhere at a time when free speech is often under attack.
There are many issues that, you know, writers are told, look, you go there, it won't just be conscious that you'll get a lot of backlash, particularly you get backlash on social media, as you know yourself, Derval, if you say something that people disagree with, but it's at another level when there's a threat of assassination. It's just very violent reactions to examples of freedom of speech are difficult to deal with. There's a sense as well that writers have to be allowed to use their imagination and to imagine themselves into other characters, other situations, sometimes playing devil's advocate. Just because you're putting forward something for discussion doesn't mean that you necessarily agree with it. But the reaction can be just so belligerent that it acts as a deterrent in some cases. So I think that Salman Rushdie was very courageous never to back down on this, and always to insist on his right to free speech, and must be supported for this.
Yes. Well, listen, all of our best wishes, obviously, to Salman Rushdie as he recovers in a hospital in New York. Thank you very, very much, Martina Devlin, writer and columnist.